So Ben, I think it's fair to say that mental health comes with its ups and downs.
Yeah.
And as having a podcast with both of us who've got mental health issues, it's quite nice because sometimes one of us picks the other one up.
Yeah.
And sometimes both of us are up.
Yeah, yeah. They're the good ones.
Yeah. What do we do when we're both down?
Drown, I guess. I don't know. Both free fall.
Let's see how we feel after this, shall we? let's get the show going.
All right. Yeah, so. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Every Move Ever podcast. My name is Ben Gross.
And my name is Rob McFarlane. Welcome to the show, a movie podcast / mental health check-in, a very needed one.
Yes.
The two broken-brained best friends talking around their problems, but not about their problems. I mean, we'll see. whilst laughing at movies.
Yeah.
Look, it's a rough one this week, but we're going to do it.
I had a laugh with this one. It wasn't a happy laugh. It was sheer rage, but it was sort of like it was a laugh. There was some chuckles in there.
We got so much to get into. Let's first of all deal with the most important thing, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, great, mate. Fucking buzzard. I keep sitting in my family house spare room, earning when I break down my salary, earning roughly £7 to £8 per hour at the age of 36. And then I think, 5 years ago, I was really fucking close to six figures.
Swear jar.
Oh,
I'm keeping that one in. It's one.
Is this fine? More my day just got better.
Yeah, it didn't.
So I'm looking back being sort of like, I was like a gnat's wing. There you go.
There we
saved
go.
It. I was a gnat's wing away from six figures 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And now I'm 36 sitting in a spare room in a family house earning £7 to £8 an hour when you really break down my salary. It's really good. I spent all day with a migraine. Well, that was nice. I vomited in an alleyway twice, rinsed my mouth out with mouthwash, and then immediately went back to work. It was really fun, man. It was the one. Great. How are you, buddy?
Well, I feel like I've really put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure that David Fincher is right, that we really nail this series. Mm-hmm. And I've sort of turned it into a big golem where I'm like, this just dominates my mind. I'm like, we've got to nail Fincher. We've got to really do the job with Fincher. And then I've looked at our week and gone, we've got about 45 minutes to record an episode tonight. And then we've just got a million and one things to do until it's released. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, oh God, we're failing. We're already failing. And I'm just in a spiral of like the one thing in my life that I really unequivocally enjoy with no complexity.
Nailing Fincher.
Sitting down with you.
Oh, okay.
Talking about movies.
Yeah.
And we've barely got time to do that. So Ben, what are we doing this week besides drowning in our mental health issues?
Well, this week, buddy, we are back on our Fincher train. We're covering every David Fincher movie ever.
Yeah.
And having nailed our episodes on Alien 3 and 7, we're diving headfirst into the game.
The late 2000s rapper, right?
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
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 But the reason I asked that is because very few people remember this film.
Good.
I don't remember this film all that well before I started watching it. Name a song by the rapper The Game.
Game Gone. Give it to you. I don't know. I don't know any.
Right, exactly.
I don't know
there
any.
We go. I think The Game, it's a poor title for your artistic projects because no one remembers it. And when they do revisit, they're disappointed.
I think Fincher got messed over on this. So he called his movie The Game. Writers, our generation invented The Game. Whereas, I'm not sure if you remember the rules of the game, but if you think of the game, you lose the game. You know what I mean? So we've just lost the game. All of our listeners have just lost the game. You're welcome, by the way. Fincher, biggest loss of all. Because apparently our generation is just absolute nonsense that's just been let to survive on their own.
Right.
Without carers or a direction.
We've got a lot to get into this week, though.
Go on.
We're going to get into what David Fincher was up to after the release of Seven.
We're going to get into... This film is nonsense, Rob.
Yes, but we're going to get into why this film might be nonsense.
We're going to get into who am I supposed to be rooting for in this capitalist sob story about a sad millionaire.
And I'm going to rebut that with probably the human being at the center of it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, fine. Yeah. I'm excited for this one because, to be honest, I watched this film and was a little bit like, I might hate Rob, but I also might hate David Fincher. I don't know where the rage goes, but it needs to leave.
Both of those are incredibly valid things to think and feel. However, yeah. I think David Fincher, you've been a bit unfair because he's more than a director now. He's an institution. And I think it's important
okay.
with any institution, you see how it got there. Mm-hmm. You see how the man became the myth, became the legendary OCD, has to be in control at every moment, can't let go, monster with a movie camera.
Okay, okay. I'm down for this.
Got a question for you, Ben.
Hit me with it.
Where Fincher at? Where that man been?
What that Fincher do?
What that Fincher do since Seven?
So, the release of Seven saw widespread critical acclaim for Fincher as a director. The movie pulled in $300+ million at the box office, which is insane.
Woo!
And Richard Francis Bruce was nominated at the Academy Awards for Best Editing.
He was. Now, Fincher decided to strike while the album's hot and immediately get working on his next feature.
Yeah.
But he did moonlight a little bit and do a music video for a super forgettable song by a super forgettable band. He's got buzz about him. He's had a hit, but it's, you know, it's make or break time now for Fincher.
Are you gonna say the name of the song or the band?
Because... I am, mate, but I have to Google it because I've forgotten.
Okay.
And I know that sounds like a bit, but...
I was going to say, if this is a bit, that's driven me literally insane, and my skin feels like it's covered in ants right now.
it was The Wallflowers.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember The Wallflowers? Remember their hit song, Sixth Avenue Heartbreak?
No.
No. See? I had a point, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. All right, yeah. At least my skin's not on fire now, so that's nice.
True. When and where, mate? When and where was this magnum opus of things that you hate in film made?
Cast your mind back with me, Rob. Ready?
Right.
It's 1997.
Ooh.
Tony Blair has just been elected as Prime Minister of the UK.
Yes.
The Heaven's Gate cult have all just killed themselves.
Even better.
Titanic is ruling the box office as we speak.
I actually quite enjoy that film.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. The best CGI I've ever seen is in Titanic.
What?
Yeah, I'm going to show you some
clips. It's fine for the time. It's fine for the time.
No, it isn't. It's melted Sims.
Okay.
Princess Diana dies like a phone signal.
What?
In a tunnel. David Fincher is given $70 million to make The Game?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How much did it make? Stick around to find out because Rob's going to be telling me it because I don't know it. I want to know it because it's going to make me angry.
What does this film mean to you, Ben?
I'm
desperate to know because you've seen this before, right?
No, this was my first time watching it for this episode, right? It's my very first time. I didn't even know that this film existed.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, that's probably a blessing because if I had have seen this film before, it would have been once and once only.
Right.
Because this film made me hate Fincher a little bit.
Oh.
No. Okay, I'm coming off strong and it's because I'm in a bit of a pout.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming off strong. It didn't make me hate Fincher a bit. The film is gorgeous. It's shot incredibly well. It's a super, super... delicate,
right.
Beautifully well-made film. It's mm-hmm. just the story is absolute waffle for me, man. There is nothing for me in this story whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
All of it's nonsense. All of it's stupid.
Right.
The worst thing about these films, right, is I get that it's supposed to be like the twisty-turny, who can you trust, who can you not? I called it immediately and then just watched it play out and I was thinking, oh, I can't wait for Fincher to prove me wrong. I'm going to feel like such an idiot. And then when the ending came around and I was like, I hate that I got this. I hate it because I said something stupid.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, this is going to be like a stupid thing. No, it was it. That was it.
I think I saw this film many, many years ago.
Okay.
And I think I remembered it as, oh, it's kind of interesting. It's not the greatest, but it's, you know, it's a bit paranoid. It's a bit delusional. It's a little bit like, oh, what's real?
Okay.
I rewatched it thinking I knew what the film was and I was struck by how incredibly dull and slow and predictable it was.
Yeah.
But then I looked around at what it meant to everyone else and that there are people who truly love this. They go, oh, it's a classic. It's a this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
And I think I know why. We're going to get into it, but before we do, for the people that have seen this film and want to be reminded a little bit of you know, maybe people like me who thought they knew what they were getting into, we're going to remind you. We're going to break down the plot. For people who are planning to watch this and haven't yet,
don't.
Now's your chance to pause. Now's your chance to pause and see. All right. Now's your chance to kind of go, oh, I'm going to pause there.
Yeah.
But here's your spoiler warning.
But immediately come back. Immediately return to us. Come home. You know, yeah. Welcome in. The water's just right. Settle in. Oh my God. We sound like Heaven's Gate now. Drink the Kool-Aid. Exactly.
We've
got new Nike shoes.
I think Heaven's Gate were a bit chirpier though. I think they were like, yay, come with us and drink the Kool-Aid. Whereas we're a little bit more like, oh, fucking hell.
Swear jar, Rob. Swear jar.
Well, that's one each now.
All right.
There we go.
I'm not happy about it, but that's fine.
Shall we play the jingle?
Having a breakdown.
We are having a breakdown. What are we doing on air?
I don't know.
Why are we doing this? I just want to take a romantic bath with a toaster.
Oh, God. Even my toaster left me. You know what I mean? That's how upset it is.
Nicholas Van Orton is a wealthy investment banker living a cold, isolated life.
Aww.
On his 48th birthday, his estranged brother Conrad, played by Sean Penn, re-enters his life and gives him a mysterious voucher for a game provided by a company called Consumer Recreation Services, CRS.
Yeah.
Nicholas, though although initially skeptical, becomes intrigued and visits CRS to inquire about the game. After undergoing a series of psychological and physical tests, he is told that the game will soon begin and will transform his life in unexpected ways.
The game starts subtly, with seemingly minor disruptions to Nicholas's orderly life, but soon escalates into a series of increasingly surreal and dangerous events. His bank accounts are drained, his house is vandalized, and he is pursued by unknown assailants. At first, Nicholas believes the game to be a cleverly orchestrated form of entertainment, but as the danger intensifies, he begins to lose control and becomes increasingly paranoid. He suspects that CRS is a front for a criminal conspiracy designed to ruin him. Idiot. This sets up the central theme of the film, the dissolution of Nicholas's sense of control and his descent into chaos, a journey that mirrors the unraveling of his carefully curated life.
As Nicholas's paranoia peaks, he becomes convinced that everyone around him is part of the conspiracy, including his brother Conrad. He believes that the game has blurred the lines between reality and fiction, pushing him towards psychological collapse. The game forces Nicholas into situations that strip away his rationality, echoing the idea that his carefully constructed identity is just a facade. The film suggests that true growth can only come from experiencing vulnerability, a stark contrast to Nicholas's rigid adherence to power and dominance.
In the climax, Nicholas seemingly reaches his breaking point when, in a final confrontation with CRS, he accidentally shoots Conrad. Overwhelmed with guilt and grief, he jumps from the roof of a he jumps from the roof of a building, apparently intending to end his life. However, he crashes through a glass ceiling into a stage setup. Stupid. Where he learns that everything, including Conrad's death, was part of the game.
Mm.
The final revelation is both shocking and cathartic.
I've written this specifically to trigger you.
Yeah, sound. Yeah. All right. Because that was sheer rage bubble that just hit my throat.
Yeah,
that wasn't stomach acid. That was rage.
Right.
Both shocking and cathartic as Nicholas realizes that the game was designed to break him down emotionally in order to rebuild him, like some sort of weird toxic ex. The orchestrated nature of his downfall suggests that, paradoxically, Nicholas had to lose everything to gain a sense of personal freedom and self-awareness.
Yes.
So just a quick recap.
Mm-hmm.
Multi-millionaire who owns hectares of land in downtown San Francisco.
Yeah.
Is a hedge fund investment banker.
Yes.
Is a bit sad and lonely. So the entire world bends to him to make him learn a lesson of, you should really take a look around and appreciate what you got, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah.
The end.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Excellent film. this film is nonsense.
It is.
This film is nonsense. It's pure nonsense. It's incredibly well shot.
Right.
It's a beautiful film to look at. It's the acting is insane. It's incredible. The thing that gets me is that at every point the film asks you to suspend disbelief, it
yes.
then immediately increases the nonsense tenfold and is like, we've done it a bit. Just come on, just do the next bit. Just see how you feel at the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it increases its nonsense tenfold and it's like, well, you've done it before. Just do it again. You know what I mean? And at the end of the film, I felt like I was Nicholas because I was just right. going along with it, not knowing if right. I could trust Fincher anymore. And I was still doing the stuff that he was telling me not to do.
Okay, that's fascinating. I was going to bring this up earlier, mm-hmm. but part of, I didn't enjoy this film either. I found it dull. I found it unbelievable. And I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for all sorts of things. You know, same. Godzilla X Kong, love it.
Tremors, this, best film I've ever right, seen. You know what I mean?
Right. This, it just didn't do it. It didn't do it.
No.
I get that some people suspended their disbelief, enjoyed it. I didn't. But the thing that I found interesting about what you said is that you were left like Nicholas. You didn't know if you could trust or enjoy David Fincher.
Yeah.
And David Fincher says again and again in his interviews that what he wanted to do with this film, not what he achieved, he doesn't claim that,
okay.
but what he was attempting to do was play with the mystery genre.
He does that. He does
and
do that.
He constantly
that.
Goes on about, like, whenever I shoot something, yeah. I have to, I'm telling the audience that they have to pay attention.
Yeah.
If I just throw a shot of a drawer into the middle of a scene halfway through,
yeah.
the audience is now going, there's something in that drawer.
Oh my God. The amount of times, dude, there are so many tiny details that I paid attention to for no reason because they meant nothing.
Right.
But they were so right. prevalent.
Right.
There's a reoccurring theme with flowers. Mm-hmm. And it's one bouquet of flowers that I spotted in a hotel lobby. Just some woman carrying a jar of flowers. And I was like, that's going to come back.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean anything.
They came back twice.
Right.
Same flowers. And they're sort of degrading as time goes on, as flowers would.
Mm-hmm.
It meant nothing. Meant nothing right. to no one. There was no reason for it to be. There was no reason whatsoever. The only thing that I got from it was I was like, okay, so all that's told me is that the woman with the flowers is in on the game. And then that was it. That was the
right.
that's the end of my investigation. I'm back being a little kid with a German pocket dictionary pretending it's a mystery novel. Do you know what I mean? Like that's that's just it. The thing that really got to me about the nonsensical story is suspending belief is entirely mm-hmm. fine. Like I can yep. I do it daily. Whenever I watch a film of my choosing, I suspend my belief indefinitely.
Yes.
The only thing with doing that is that it comes in sort of a broad sense. It's never right. it's never laser focused suspended mm-hmm. disbelief. The yep. Am I allowed to talk about the end of the film where we've mentioned it in the breakdown, but you know the bit he's struck with grief at shooting Conrad?
Right. Yeah.
There are two moments here that snapped me out of it wildly because he's on top of a massive, massive building.
Oh yeah, it's like 90 stories.
Yeah, and he's surrounded by people, right?
Yeah.
There is a whole roof for him to choose of where to jump from.
He's got 360 degrees of freedom as to where he throws himself off this building.
CRS have planned mm-hmm. the exact point that he is going to throw himself off. Not just the point of where he's going to throw himself off, but they've also pre-calculated the velocity,
right.
the depth of everything,
yeah.
the distance that he's going to fall, and he essentially falls onto one of those big blow-up stuntman mattresses.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened, and I was like, okay, all right, listen, all right, that's ridiculous, but maybe they have some sort of like weird Minority Report 3 cognitives like in a swimming pool in a back room somewhere, right?
They're trying to hint that with the testing at the start.
Yeah.
Like they know him better than he knows him.
Right, okay.
They know everything about how he thinks and
that's
how he
fine.
Makes decisions. And
the second bit of that scene that broke me out of it, Rob, is that his brother Conrad makes it down 90 floors in the same through conventional measures. There is mm-hmm. there is lifts and stairs that are available to him, right?
Yep.
There is him and two actors that make it down to the ground floor in the same amount of time that Nicholas does, and Nicholas is free falling.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's either time travel or it's some sort of like enormous slide that was built into the building.
Yeah. So there are people that are going to say like, oh, you're just thinking about it too much, you know, it's just a film, you two are nerds. And it's like, yeah, but we're not the ones we're not the ones who've set out the stall.
Exactly.
Of think yeah. about this, right? Finch is gone. Apply real world rules and try and figure this out. And then when we do, and it doesn't make sense, you can't then pull the rug and go, oh, we shouldn't be thinking so much.
Yeah.
It's literally a mystery film.
Yes. It's like someone saying, do you want to come to the cinema with me? And then they drive you to a field and just throw eggs at you for 6 hours. And you're like, right. This isn't a film. And they're like, no, just don't think about it, mate.
Right.
Don't think
right.
about it. I didn't set myself up for this. You've given yes. me a premise that I've gone into thinking this is what's happening. And now I'm covered in egg.
I've got reasonings for all of this, but, and why I think it's like this.
Okay.
But as a contemporary viewer, mm-hmm. I think we've changed habits a lot. And there were just little bits 1,000%. Of it where I was going, can you imagine trying to get insurance?
Oh, my days.
For this game?
Yes.
Like, if I just, like, you be the CRS rep, right? That, trying to get insurance. I'll be the insurance company. Ready?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi. Is this public liability or us?
It is, yes, it is. Yes.
Welcome. Hi, how are you doing? My name's Derek. I'm phoning from a company called CRS.
Brilliant. How can I help you with insurance today?
Right, so we need insurance. So essentially, there's a multimillionaire in San Francisco who's a bit sad. So right. what we've planned is the entire world is going to come to a standstill and we're going to shoot live rounds of ammunition at him through walls, through windows.
Right.
We're going to chase him down in cars. There is one part of our plan that involves hiring an actor to pretend to be a taxi driver. The taxi driver is going to lock him inside a taxi
right.
with child locks on, so obviously he can't escape.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that he has a crank for a window that we've laid out somewhere previously,
right.
just in his pocket. He hasn't put it down anywhere before getting a taxi, because that would be silly.
Mm.
And we're going to drive that into a river and then just hope that he gets out in time.
Okay.
Also, we're going to convince him that he's killed his own brother with a gun that we hadn't planned for. We've planned for the gun. Don't worry, there's blanks in right. the gun. I don't want to cause a public insurance nightmare here. Right. Okay. There's blanks in the gun, but he's not going to know that. He's going to think that this is new information to us. He's going to shoot his brother. We're going to pretend that he's killed his brother. He's going to be so grief-stricken that he's going to throw himself off a building. There is no railings. There's no point of like, jump here. It's a complete free will choice. But what we've done is we've pre-cogged the exact point that he's going to be jumping from. And we're just going to put a mattress there. Also, we're building an enormous 90-story slide to make sure that his recently not shot brother can get down to the ballroom just in time for when the man who's committing suicide lands on the mattress.
Buddy, I would have hung up 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, same, to be honest. I would have been like, why is this my job? Why do I have to make this call?
So yes, it is nonsense.
Yeah.
It is nonsense. There are two things that I think are going on.
Hmm.
I think there's the way it was meant to be seen.
Okay.
Which is long gone, right? I think it's long gone. We'll get back to that.
Okay.
But I'm going to offer you a little olive branch here, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, the film's not good. But it's more enjoyable if you choose to watch it this way.
Okay.
What if... You and I have had our issues about mental health. You know, the whole show is structured around the fact that this is good for us to chat.
Yeah.
Who does Nicholas have to chat to?
His paid cleaner, his housewife.
But he's not choosing to, right? He's not talking to anyone. He's at the same age that his father was when his father killed himself by suicide.
Yeah.
He's under an extreme pressure, but he's also not happy.
Yeah.
You and I have both been in situations where we're just going through the motions, not because we enjoy the motions, but just because that's kind of the easiest thing to do.
Yeah.
And then we got more and more unwell and we began to lose touch with the reality a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if CRS is a sort of allegory for accepting with open arms the consequences of not looking after yourself.
Oh.
And then the whole film is him having a paranoid breakdown, ending with his suicide, which the second he hits the ground, everyone's there, everyone's happy.
And everything's better.
And everything's better because Ooh. It's all fixed now.
Okay, that's terrifying because I hadn't thought of it that way. And also, right. we were both massively career-driven. I
right.
sacrificed all of my relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh, hate that.
It makes the film make sense because all of the idiocy that happens in the plot,
it does.
If you look at it as an allegory for
yeah.
this man didn't take care of himself, and now, because all of the stuff that happens to him is proper rich guy paranoia. They're going to take my money.
Yeah.
Does she want to fuck me? No, she wants to kill me.
But also, swear jar, but also...
Three.
That's three. But also, the whole point of the world coming to a stop and him being the literal main character of everything makes perfect sense.
Center of attention.
Because it's his breakdown and it's his. Oh my God, that's.
Yeah.
Is Fincher a genius? Is this what this film is? Have I come into this like iron heart for the wrong thing? The worst thing is, right, is you've known this. I've been texting you, being sort of like, I hate it, Rob. It's this. And you've been sitting on this the entire time. Oh, well, like, buddy.
I don't think it's the intent. I think it's an optional way of watching the movie that makes it tolerable.
Choose that
you
way.
You still struggle with the fact that you cannot sympathize with his character anymore.
No, I hate him, but it makes him more relatable because, you know, when I was going through this stuff, I hated myself too. Do you know what I mean? So, like, it kind of makes it more relatable at this point. I'm so conflicted right now. I'm unsure how to feel. This is actually making me spiral. Are you in on it? Is this the game?
I genuinely, for this episode, you're lucky I didn't have the time.
Right.
But I know some of your friends.
Yeah, you do.
And so I was going to message them and ask them to ask you like the same question, but from different angles.
Rob, you know all my friends because I have like six. If you would have texted the small group of friends that I have and they started asking me these questions, I might have killed myself.
Right, so this is why I didn't. Because what I was going to do is I was going to get friends from Control or Critique and a couple from the Boardroom Gaming Cafe.
Yeah, that's all my friends.
Just
thank you.
Get them to ask you what time Telford train station closed. Because that was just like a standard thing. Like, oh, I'm thinking, you know.
Right.
And then the game at the end of the episode, the last question of the quiz would be, what time does Telford train station go?
I'd have flipped my desk. I'd have flipped my desk and set myself on fire. I wouldn't know how to handle it.
The only reason I didn't is because I realized that like there's such a thing as too far.
Yeah, I'd have never trusted you again. The next episode, it would have been the most straight cut. Hello, I'm Ben Groves and I am alone. I can trust no one. I don't understand what's going on. And you'd be like, I'm Rob McFarlane. I'll be like, are you?
Right. And I feel like it would have gotten in the way of people's ability to sympathize when I was like, yeah, I've struggled with my mental health. And they'd be like, yeah, but you do torture your best mate.
Yeah, you are a puppet master.
There we are.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a replacement and the only thing that came to my mind was more swear words.
And this is why we're doing a swear jar, Ben. It's for our betterment.
Yeah, it's for a broader vocabulary. I've already learned three words.
Right, you know puppet master.
Puppet master.
That's two.
Pastiche. There's three.
Pastiche. Done. There you go. Job done.
This is genuinely making my day. Thank you so much for this. This is the best idea. Like, honestly, we were dreading it earlier. This is the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
My main problem is, well, it was my main problem. The whole show's ruined now because all of my notes are now, now my notes are the nonsense because you've switched the film around and it makes perfect sense to me. My next rant, which is a paragraph and a half long, Rob, thanks for that. It only took like 40 minutes to write. The next rant that I'm now not going to be able to make any sense of is, but who am I supposed to sympathize with? Like, I don't like the film because the character is an absolute tosser. Tosser's not a swear word. It's a person who throws things. He tosses.
Right, yes, he does. He tosses people out like garbage.
And if you've watched the game, you'll know that he tosses at least one book.
Right, exactly.
And at least one lady.
She injured herself in that throw.
Really?
Yeah, so she jumped from the thing into the trash can and got a very severe injury.
She was wearing no underwear at the time.
Well, she fractured a bone in her foot.
Wow.
And it wasn't a prop dumpster either. It was a real dumpster and it had real rats in it.
Why was it? Okay. If you're shooting it for a film, move the camera a bit closer and maybe don't do it from 30 feet in the air, right?
But maybe it's a game, Ben.
Don't do this to me. Don't do this to me.
No, he is. He is a cock. But I will say this.
Cock's not a swear word. It's a
male chicken.
It's a male chicken.
What I find fascinating about your and my reaction to this film is how and why things date. So there's the obvious ones, right? Where you'll look at, say, a 1950s romance film.
Yeah.
Or like The Wolfman, like 1930s, 40s Universal Monsters.
Yeah.
Where his behavior with women is just predatory.
Yes. It's awful.
And you think, as a contemporary viewer, you're like, oh, this is why he's the Wolfman.
Yeah.
No, it's just an also-ran. It's just...
Yeah.
That's how men were with women.
Yeah, men used to buy telescopes to perv on women, and that was completely fine, guys. That was a thing.
That was just like, oh, that was a thing. Oh.
And everyone just carried on living their lives. What a quirky guy. He's just got four telescopes pointed at four different women's windows.
The Wolfman pre-bite sees a woman from across the town working in a shop that he thinks pretty. So just turns up at her work every day until eventually he gets to kiss her.
I think this is why we're single.
By sheer force of pestering.
You know what I mean? A, we can't afford telescopes, and B, we're just not that determined. You know what I mean?
It's called, we're not willing to be predators. I think this film has a similar issue, right?
That's a t-shirt right there, isn't it?
We're not willing to be predators.
Single, taken, not willing to be a predator.
I think this has a similar issue, and I think it's interesting. It's only now that we've sat down to watch it and both hated the protagonist that I've kind of realized how much of a sea change in society it was. But we never used to hate investment bankers.
No.
This is pre the crash of 2008. This is in the big, it's called the 90s boom, the 1990s economic boom, which was the largest economic expansion that happened in the West until 2019. Clinton's economic policies meant huge increase in wealth, a decrease in inequality. Everybody was loving Wall Street.
Okay.
I don't think the casting of Michael Douglas in this movie is an accident, seeing that he played Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. Greed is good.
Yeah.
We're in an era of the 90s thriller, right? So you've got Harrison Ford running around asking for his family back. You've got Richard Gere apparently being watchable.
Yeah. Richard Gere's phenomenal. Don't ever say a bad word about him again. He's fantastic. If by any chance he ever hears this, adopt me immediately.
Right. He's got one face, Ben, and it's the George Clooney look down, smile to oneself with a little giggle, mm-hmm. and then look up.
Works on me every time, mate. Every time. Every time I see that happen, goosh.
Right.
Goosh.
But that's the era of thriller we were living in. We're living in Kiss the Girls. We're living in that kind of 90s Seven, for God's sake, which was a deconstruction of this genre. And I think this is Fincher taking it so far it breaks.
It's gone full circle.
This is him. Yeah. This is him doing Psychobilly, where we had rock and roll.
Let's just
make it so fast and so outrageous and so silly that it's not that anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm with it.
And I think perversely, we are expected, and it is understood that we're going to sympathise with this character. And what this film was doing at its time was presenting the very new idea. Mm-hmm. That maybe this guy wasn't someone you wanted to look up to. That was new information.
Okay.
That whole thing of like, he's got it all, but you weren't expecting this. He's lonely and unfulfilled. And people were like, oh my God, really?
He's just like us. But instead of me crying into an empty bowl of porridge, he cries in a Mercedes Benz.
Exactly that.
Surrounded by lavish hookers and champagne. And
I think the film is teaching us information that is now basic film, basic social literacy.
Okay, so looking at it through that lens, it does give it a slightly different tinge of color that I was unaware was there.
It still sucks to be a contemporary viewer and be like, yeah, great.
It's you know, watching it for the first time this time around. I watched it surface value as well. I didn't make the allegory that we've just discussed. It was a case of me taking it very literally and trying to digest the story.
Yeah,
which I don't feel like I did necessarily as well. I have a thought on an allegory that I made that made it palatable for me.
Right,
but not necessarily true.
Right.
I'll get to that shortly. I think my main issue was the fact that...
It's because he's rich. You just don't like him because he's rich.
It's not rich, though. It's not rich. It's uber rich. This is like the creme de la creme of the 1%. And it's like, I'm not going to feel
bad. You've got your massive chip on your shoulder because that's not a person anymore.
Right. I do have a chip on my shoulder, but it's not for that reason, right?
And I used to have one too. Like, I went to a grammar school, man. I was the poor kid at the grammar school. Yeah. And it was like, oh, where did you summer? And me being like, my mum's house where I live.
If there wasn't a bomb threat at our school at least once a month, it was because the one guy that would always call in bomb threats was off for that month. Like, the fire brigade used to... The amount of times we'd get like evacuated from school, the first bomb threat, we were miles away.
Yeah.
We were miles away. By the sixth or seventh that year, we were in a building that was 7 feet away. All looking at the windows, watching the firemen climb to the roof. That was it. That was the experience.
Let's just keep the walk short.
Everyone was like, well, we're not going all the way over there. We know who it is. We know what's going on. The fire brigade are here. They're already bored.
Yeah.
They're ticking it off as they're going along. They're showing up with the forms pre-filled out now. you know what I mean? like, but that's the thing. So my thing is like, I don't have a chip on my shoulder per se, because the uber rich and like the rich, I feel like there's a difference between rich and wealthy.
Right.
And I don't have a chip on my shoulder for wealth, because I feel like I've met a lot of wealthy people in my life,
right,
that have made my life better just for knowing them.
Okay.
An old boss that I used to work for was, and it still is to this day, an incredible source of inspiration. I won't mention names or anything.
Right.
An incredible source of inspiration. He finished university with a degree and had like a little egg that he'd been building up over a few years, and he used that to start a business.
Okay.
And what he did with that business is he was like, right, I don't know as much as I could do about this business. And rather than punish mm-hmm. himself for that, is he found other people who knew it inside and out and went, I've got some money.
Okay.
Work together.
Yep.
And everyone was like, sure, okay. And then he started making more money. And then what he did with that money was invest it in the people.
Mm.
And the way that he did it is, it was incredible. He wasn't showy. He wasn't this, that, and the other. Family was a huge thing to him. I know you get these like weird companies that are like, we're a family here.
Yeah, it's always exploitation.
Yeah, it's always exploitation, right? This guy used to have us around to his house, and he'd spend 3 or 4 hours cooking stuff on a barbecue just to make sure that everyone okay. was fed and, you know, feeling good, and then would genuinely listen to your insights and act on them.
Right, so he's reinvesting in the people that have invested in him.
He's doing it right. He's wealthy, his family's big, he's doing this, that, yeah.
He's giving back.
Running around in Ferraris and all this stuff. He's got a Tesla, he's got a nice house, but that's it. Everything else is invested in places that it needs to be invested,
mm-hmm.
and it's put to good. And he's a better person for it, because you can see how much of a difference it makes to his life, which positively impacts everyone around him. And I'm like, dude, this is...
Of course.
It made me hate him a little bit more, because I was like, oh, okay. So you're a multi-hundred millionaire, but also you're incredibly nice. Your personality is fantastic, and you've got all the correct morals. Whoop-dee-doo. Fantastic. Well done.
Okay, yeah.
But he was incredible. My problem with this film is that the character isn't wealthy. He's rich. He's an absolute cock to everyone that he comes into contact with. He destroys a man's life in front of his family and then walks away like nothing, like it's nothing, just water off a duck's back.
Yeah, he's being Mr. Ruthless, he's being Mr. Efficient, he's being business is business. It's why just, do I care about your sub story it if it's affecting it's my profits sort of like, for the shareholders?
Yeah, okay, so you can cripple a man's entire livelihood for a stock, all right?
Right,
fine, you do that. But that doesn't make me ever want to be like, aw, are you a bit sad?
Okay. I mean, there's some extenuating factors there in that, you know, the guy he's crippling, he's basically buying the company out. So he's leaving him millions of pounds better off. He's just stopping the business that the man does because the business is failing. I think what I find interesting, though, with the chip on your shoulder is the sentence that this film is I'm rich, but I'm not happy, right?
Right.
I'm not happy. And you see the resources that this man has and you go, well, I don't have those resources. And if I had those resources, here's what I would do with it. Mm-hmm. I'd build a company. I'd reinvest. That would make me happy.
Sure.
And the assumption there is that they haven't tried that and they haven't found out already mm-hmm. that doesn't make them happy either.
1,000%.
The guy's already employing people.
Yeah.
It's not shown that he's actively doing this, that, or the other, but he's got, the shareholder's got this. I find the interesting thing about the chip on the shoulder about the ultra rich is I look at someone who I hate, Elon Musk,
mm-hmm.
with a passion.
Sure.
But when I look at that man and I go, he's doing what he feels is necessary to feel like he's all right, like he's happy. And he's just gone super wrong about how he's going to get that.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't invalidate the fact that the start of the sentence is, I'm not happy.
Yeah, 1,000%.
And on a human level, you have to go...
1,000%, I do.
I can disagree about how you're re-spending your resources, this, that, or the other, mm-hmm. but you're still a human being, right?
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Like, and Vladimir Putin, unequivocal villain of the fucking...
Well, this took a sharp left turn, but let's continue down this
one. Vladimir Putin, from my perspective, a disgusting human being.
Sure.
But I don't want him... I want him to be able to find a way of being all right. Because if he's all right, he'll probably stop trying to invade people, right?
Maybe. Like, maybe.
I don't feel like happy, well people go, I'm going to invade a country. I don't feel like happy, well people go, I'm going to buy Twitter and turn it into a race hate website.
I was trying to think of examples of someone that's invaded a country and just been super happy about it. Like, how would that even look? You know what I mean, boys, guess what I've just done? Dude, right. Have you seen the news? Italy's at war. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, guess what I just did? Right. Bud, I need to ask you one question. Where's our army?
Right.
This is the funny one. You ready for this one? Italy. Right. It's in Italy, mate.
Right. Right, exactly.
Why'd you do that? Don't know.
But you don't see the Dalai Lama being like, oh, mate, do you know what I need to do? Mm. I need to fire some people. Do you know what I need to do? I need to hold freak parties with hundreds of bottles of lube in my mansion.
Maybe. Right? I mean,
I feel like these people having a reset.
Yeah.
Michael Douglas in this film having a reset and going, oh, I was going a little bit mad there, wasn't I?
Yeah.
That's a good thing, right? And just because he started from a position of being a tosser doesn't mean that him not being a tosser anymore is a bad thing.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's just, it's hard to relate to. It's really hard to relate to.
But it feels like you would rather have him stay unhappy and stay hurting people because you'd resent him being happy if he changed.
Absolutely not. I'm super happy that he's changing and he's learning how to, you know, cherish his loved ones and be a slightly better person. very slightly better person. The exchange between him and the guy's life that he destroyed by literally just ending his career in front of his family. Even that's horrible to watch when they're nicey-nice to each other and it's like, oh!
Right.
It's just, I'm glad that he did it. The only thing that bothers me is that because he's uber rich, it's everyone else's problem. And it's, I just didn't care. Yeah. Like, Rob, I'm so invested in you and I love you with all of my heart. For you to do better.
Likewise.
You could be invading Italy right now and I would be like, buddy, I'm with you, but I need you to be doing better right now and I'm invested in it because I love you, right?
Yeah.
My worst enemy invades Italy and it's like, I'm just trying to be better. I'm like, couldn't care less. Still invaded Italy. Know what I mean? I'm not there for it because I don't care about him in the slightest. And it's this disconnect that it has where it puts me in such a different realm of existence where I just, it's like I'm looking at it thrice removed going, there is nothing here for me to latch on. Nothing.
There's the disconnect of the budget the main character is living on. There's the disconnect of the style of cinema that was prevalent in the 90s. There's the disconnect of the fact it's Michael Douglas and I've never liked that guy, particularly as an actor, because I've just never really bonded with him. He's got a odd face.
I quite like his odd face. This is the film that it hurt me a little bit because I was like, I quite like this guy. Wall Street, that was funny. You know what I mean?
Right. But I got to the point, I was like, why did Fincher, because Fincher doesn't write his own scripts, he picks them. Mm-hmm. And I looked into it and this was the film that Fincher was going to make before he made Seven. He was offered this first, right?
Sure.
And in the story of Fincher, it would be a much shorter series.
Yes.
If he had.
Because I would not have watched Seven.
He'd have come off the back of Alien 3.
Yeah.
And then he'd have done this. And I don't think this would have had anywhere near the success that it did, especially seeing as he rewrote a lot of this script with Andrew Kevin Walker. Because originally it was going to be a younger guy playing the Nicholas Van Orton character.
Right. That would have made
it
worse.
And it was going to be a much lighter tone. And it was going to be like, wouldn't it be fun if a billionaire could have his thing reset, blah, 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 rather than what I think it is, which is a kind of social commentary on how the ultra rich are lonely, desperately broken people. And the only way to really fix it is for them to spend the GDP of a small nation by hiring, you know, actors. That even simple things, the ending, right? So at the end of this movie, he's had his big fall.
Yeah.
He comes out.
Yeah.
And then he wanders off and he meets the woman who's been
lying to him.
Kind of the other main character in the game.
Yeah.
And stringing him along through scenario, through scenario, through scenario.
Yeah.
She's about four different identities.
She's like his handler.
And he stops and he's like, oh, maybe you and I get a coffee at the airport.
Oh.
And she's like, yeah, maybe. And I'm like, oh, this is gross.
No.
Because he's the ultramillionaire that she's been paid between £7 and £8 an hour to entertain, right?
Yeah. But in all fairness to her, though, she's shooting a shot. She's like, this is my way out. This is my ticket out of the £7 an hour gig. You know what I mean?
But then isn't that dystopian in its own sense?
Yes, Rob. It's horrid.
There's an alternate ending, which Fincher, again, was fighting with the studio. There was an alternate ending where Nicholas leaves the party,
right,
declines a cab, and then just walks off into the night alone into the city by himself.
Okay.
Leaving it open as to how he felt about the whole thing.
That
would have been a far superior
that
ending.
That would have been an amazing ending, because that would have left it open to being like, it's done nothing for me. Now I just have shed loads of trauma that I need to deal with.
Right.
And now I need to wander off on my own and live my super lonely... Go fix my graffitied mansion for a start. You know what I mean?
But Fincher himself says he's not proud of this film.
I get it.
He agrees with his wife, who produced the film, that he shouldn't have made the film.
Okay.
And he said that they couldn't get the third act. And it was my... And I quote, it was my fault because I thought if you could just keep your foot on the throttle, it would be liberating and funny.
Even his wife was like, you shouldn't have done this, bud. This is what... I love you, but this is what... It's you invading Italy. I'm your wife in You Invading Italy. Right. Oh, my God.
Yeah. but here's why I think he did it, right? I think this is Fincher proving that he can do the thing. He's had the big hit.
Yeah.
He's had... his Memento moment. Like, Nolan had Memento.
Yeah.
It was a little movie. It had a small budget, but it made a huge impact at the box office, and it was a critical darling.
Yeah.
And Fincher's had Seven, and now he needs to prove that he can do the thing, make the money, and isn't a one-trick pony. This is his Insomnia.
It does strike me as Insomnia.
Right?
Just not nowhere near as good.
See, you enjoyed Insomnia a lot more than I did.
I really did.
Yeah, it got you in some way, and I'm so jealous.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Right.
I don't know why. I was hoping that this would be the same with this. First time watching it for the show, desperately trying to impress Rob.
Right.
At the end of it. Being sort of like, wow, maybe I'm all wrong about Nolan. No. Now I was just left seething at Fincher.
But I think what this film serves is it turned a profit.
Mm-hmm.
It had an actor from a previous generation, like, say, Al Pacino or Michael Douglas.
Yep.
And the film is almost so barely there and so cliche written that the only thing left that's different that you haven't seen before is the director's style.
Yeah. No, you,
it's a vacuum in which the directorial style is the only thing left to comment on and go, oh, that was kind of interesting.
Okay. I get where you're coming from. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Like, the way that the film's shot and the way the film's presented is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, I can imagine way back when, like obviously in the 90s, when Nolan and Fincher are doing these sorts of films at roughly the same times, they're dropping similar things left, right. They've got to be in some sort of like creative... who's is bigger contest, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, right.
That was so hard to say without swearing. after watching the film and the rage bubble dissipated for a little bit, and I was like, even when they're sad, they've got to make the whole world revolve around them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every single worker's paid an hourly wage to make their life, to make them learn a life
between lesson. £7 and £8.
That's what I mean, right? That's like, of course that's how the film plays out. Sure, why not? I actually started sitting and thinking about it, and I liked that it's one of these films where you can switch out the meaning, almost.
Yeah.
So instead of an uber rich person, you know, being desperately lonely and a bit of a broken person, struggling with, you know, being the same age as a father when he committed suicide, what about if it was an allegory for addiction?
Mm-hmm.
And instead of having everyone around you paid to act out a big scenario to help you learn your lesson, you have negatively impacted such a large number of people that now it's inescapable that you have to do something about the crutch that you have, right? So
100%.
Even if you're earning the mega millions, but you're destroying the lives of everyone around you, there's going to be a point where it hits you in the feels and you're going to go, is this it? Am I on the right one? So I was looking at it like addiction, and obviously, like, I tried to relate it to my scenario a few years ago where you get to a point where you're like, I don't physically think I can function as a basic human being anymore.
Right.
Because it's not...
I can't go out and work because a 10-hour shift is longer than my need for drugs.
I got to the point where I was measuring how... deserved or I got to a point where I was measuring how much drugs and drink I could consume in an evening based on how much work I'd done. If I'd traveled, let's say, from the West Midlands to the Scottish border and back in a day, I'm like,
and you've earned it.
I've earned at least six beers there. That's six. That's right. Six beers and a couple bumps. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if I do like a jaunt south all the way up and I'm gone for 12 hours and I get back, you know, 13, 14 hours later, I've hit five meetings. I've done some wicked deals. I'm like, you know what? That's a couple lines. That's a lion, a couple lines, and it's half a bottle of whiskey. That's how I was measuring my little reward at the end of the day for doing the bog standard stuff at work.
Trying to rationalize and ration your addiction.
That's all it was. It was horrendous. So the first two acts of this film are very much that, right? Yeah. Right up until the point where he meets his handler at the taxi and she's like, do you want to come and get a coffee at an airport? And he's considering it because it's essentially, in my allegory, she's addiction leading him through life, sort of showing him how he's affecting all the lives of the people around him. And at the end of the film, the addiction comes back and is like, you want to go to the airport and rail lines of cocaine off your therapist's back? And it's, you know, I mean, it's obviously that's not a feasible thing. It's not recommended. It's a fat 10 out of 10, but it's not recommended. Mm. You know what I mean?
No.
Yeah.
Well, to take your allegory then, and to take why I think this is not a film that I enjoy, but one that I think is important in Fincher's catalogue.
Okay.
As a film for a man to make who is famously addicted to being in control, going, sometimes it's good to let it go. Fincher is famous, even at this point in his career, 50 takes, 40 takes, 60 takes.
Yeah.
Everything must be perfect. Yeah. The shot must be lined up perfectly. Everything has to be exactly this way.
Yeah.
I will abandon projects three quarters of the way to completion because they're not quite right. And I'll walk away.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a pretty Nicholas Van Orton way of doing things.
It is.
Right.
Oh, no, 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 no. Hold on, hold on, hold on. You're not going to do this to me because you can't. Because this is unfair.
Right.
Because in the Seven episode, you were like, I'm going to argue that it's a perfect film based on your definition. And my definition of a perfect film is the filmmaker living a certain story and then telling that story because they're the most qualified person to do so.
So a man who's addicted to being in control, being put in a situation where all control is taken from him.
Fuck you.
And he's told what he has to do and how he has to do it. And his choice is either to jump off a building
or accept that he needs to change.
Accept that he needs to change and go with the flow a little bit more.
Fuck you, Rob.
That's five.
Is that four? Or is that five?
That's five. RRP IR inbox. Remember, guys, that the forfeit for five swears in an episode is that you get to send a picture of an owl or a crab to our DMs and social media. So off you go, lads and ladettes. Ben, it is a perfect film.
Yeah,
and I think it is also a thematic tie-in to a lot of the films that Fincher makes in this era.
Okay.
Where somebody becomes increasingly isolated because the society around them is unwell. The society that's depicted in Seven is unwell to the degree where somebody's driven to do murder.
Right.
The society in this film is so unwell that even if you've got all the money in the bank, there's still something missing. And it's apparently that sense of isolation and dread is so standardized and normalized that capitalism has created an industry around fixing it.
That's a very interesting take. I'd like to tag my little bit onto the end of that and say that the mildly attractive person that's been leading you through the ringers and lying to your face continuously, getting you into the worst situations you have ever been in, is probably worth going to the airport for a cup of coffee with. You know what I mean? And that's an important lesson that Finch is trying to teach us here, guys. You know what I mean? Give him a call. Drop him a text. You know what I mean?
Do you want to play a game?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Right. It's a really, really short one this week.
Okay.
Because the whole episode's the game, but this is the game.
I can't swear anymore.
You can't.
But no, it's there. The sentiment's there.
Did you spot the cameo Spike Jonze, the director of films like Her, Three Kings, Being John Malkovich?
I did.
A couple of Jackass movies.
Yeah.
Because, of course.
Yeah, why not? No, I didn't.
He is one of the paramedics at the end who brushes the breakaway glass off Michael Douglas's face.
Oh, hold on. No, hold on. I'm thinking of Spike Lee.
Oh my God.
That's why I didn't recognize him. But that was Spike Jones, though.
Weirdly, Spike Lee did not direct Being John Malkovich, possibly the whitest film that's ever been made.
When you said
made.
The films, I was like, I was literally like, are you sure? Are you sure he's
in this? Did you spot Michael Massey, who plays Fun Boy in The Crow?
I feel... No. No, I didn't. Sorry. I saw... No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. No, I didn't.
Well, this is a bit tasteless. Because Michael Massey plays one of the paramedics who attends to Nicholas Van Orton after he thinks he's accidentally shot someone.
Fincher might be
a supervillain.
One of the funniest supervillains that's ever existed.
And this is in 1997 as well.
Do you think that there was ever a point where Michael Massey was like, is this the game?
I'm not comfortable.
Is this the game? Am I in the game? Has he been filming me this entire time? I knew my postman was weird yesterday.
Okay, you ready for the last one?
Yeah.
Did you spot Mario?
Mario?
Mario.
Like the Super Mario?
Like Super Mario. Mario of Mario Brothers. The plumber.
The film Mario Brothers or the video game?
No. Did you spot the actor who plays Mario? Not Bob Hoskins, not Chris Pratt, the real Mario.
The real Mario?
The real Mario.
Bob Hoskins is the real Mario.
No, he's not.
Who's the real Mario?
When you played N64, Super Mario 64,
yeah,
you were listening to the voice of Charles Martinet. And Charles Martinet plays Nicholas Van Orton's father in this film. He was the voice of Mario from the year 1992
right
until 2023.
That's incredible. That's Is actually it, right? incredible. What a CV to have. So what have you right? done as an actor? Well, I was in a David Fincher film, The Game, where I killed myself from jumping off a roof. And my child found me and it ruined his life forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo!
Right. So next time you watch this dark, brooding, super intense psychological thriller that's also nonsense and ridiculous, not to be taken seriously at all.
I won't be, but okay.
In the opening credits, you can just go, it's a me.
All right, I might watch it just for that. And then I'll never watch it again.
Ben, I have to know, what are you rating? David Fincher's 1997 film, The Game.
It's two hours and 10 minutes.
That we'll
never get back. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's a punishing watch. It's a slow watch.
Yeah.
I have a lot of trust issues. So it's, mm-hmm. it's a very exhausting watch because I feel like mm-hmm. I'm 1000% in fight or fly for the entire 2 hours. But after our chat today, you asked me this yesterday, it would have been 6 and all of the points would have been for the actual filmmaking itself because the story lets it down massively.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a 6, but now it has to be a 10 because it is a perfect film. It's not my favorite perfect film, but by my definition, it is a perfect film.
Yeah, because by your definition.
It's a storyteller who is most qualified to tell the story that they're telling, putting it to film, and I cannot falter that in the slightest. It's an incredible feat doing what he's doing. It's also when you've painted it in a way where it's Fincher looking at how he needs to loosen up and let go of control a little mm-hmm. bit. It's a very vulnerable film,
right?
Might be a little bit overinflated on how much is in his bank, you know what I mean? Yeah, you know, I'm pretty in control, but I'm also super rich. Yeah.
yeah. I'm gonna rate it a 4.
Okay.
And it's because no, I'm not gonna rate it a 5. I'm exactly on the fence. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah.
It's incredibly well put together. It's incredibly shot. Everything about it is incredible, except the plot, which is so terribly paced and dull and nonsensical that I struggle to enjoy all the other stuff.
Right. Okay.
I really do.
No.
You got time for Comment Corner? I've got a fantastic one this week.
Hit me with it, man. I'm down for it.
So we got a story. We got story time in Comment Corner from an anonymous listener And they have told us a little story. You ready?
Yeah, hit me.
So I was working with someone who knows and has worked with Ridley Scott quite well. I was working with this director who they were not friends, but like good colleagues. Anyway,
okay,
this comes from a very good source, is what I'm trying to say. Basically, there was a major investor for the first Gladiator film. And he said, look, I'll give you all the remaining money on one condition, that you take my son on as someone that he gets to see Ridley every day. That's all I want. Is that he goes on there, he gets his experience in film, and he works for him and sees him every day. So he gets flown over, leave to Malta, and he's there, and everyone's going, oh, what the fuck are we going to do with him? I know, we'll give him to the ADs. The ADs go, oh, fucking hell, what are we going to do with him? And one of them has a bright idea. They go, I know, we'll have him do Ridley's breakfast every day. We'll walk up to the car, open the car, get the order, and show him to the director's trailer, and then bring him his breakfast. Sees him every day. So he walks up on the first day, opens the car door, and Ridley steps out. He goes, good morning, Ridley Diddley. Ridley Scott walks past him, says, fire that boy. And the guy was flown back out. And the reason it's my favourite story is, who the fuck would call Ridley Scott Ridley Diddley?
You, Rob. You would. That's exactly you. That's amazing for a start. Also, weird little autistic thing kicked in there. There was Fleetwood Mac, Want to Be With You Everywhere, playing in the background very distantly. And it was a little... Sorry. That's an amazing story. If I ever meet Ridley Scott, I'm 1,000% calling him Ridley Diddley.
There's two things that struck me there. Mm-hmm. One,
Fleetwood Mac. I know.
No.
Okay.
Number one, if I'd given a substantial chunk of money to a film production and said, give my son a job.
Yeah.
And he comes back on the first day fired.
Yeah.
He owes me that money now.
I'd be weirdly proud. I'd be like, fair play, mate. That was faster than I expected. You've outdone yourself there, sir.
Right.
Also, secondly, grounded.
Right. Right. And the second thing that struck me is there's going to be, God forbid this happens, but if there's a string of allegations on Twitter about Ridley Scott's conduct, there's going to be one guy who's going to be able to say, called it.
He's going to get such a payout on that as well. Yeah, I called it on day one of meeting him, and then I got fired for calling him out.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Oh, mate. I hope it never happens, but if it does, that guy's getting a payday, man.
Right.
That's incredible.
I called out P. Riddy.
P. Riddy. Oh, man. I hope
Can't
we never
wait
meet
for that
him,
series.
It's just going to be the worst, man. We're so lucky with the people that we've interviewed so far being super cool about us being absolute shithouses. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've got one here. It's an email from Jacob Clare. He has emailed in and said, hello, lads. Been listening and lurking for... This is me quoting. This isn't for the swear jar, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Hello, lads. Been listening and lurking for fucking forever. But I just wanted to say that I was your 100th five-star review on Spotify, and you all deserve 100 more five-star reviews this year. Fun fact, I live in Toronto, so owls are everywhere because of the OV hose.
Oh, yeah. That's Kendrick Drake beef stuff.
Oh,
that
I wouldn't have a clue.
You're just not cool enough to know about.
No. I'm still living in the 1980s.
Dead people.
Also, Fincher is my favorite director. So glad you guys are doing this series. Cheers, Jacob. Jacob, thank you so much for reaching out to us, buddy. And thank you so much more for the five-star review on Spotify. And I think I do agree with you. We do deserve 100 more five-star reviews this year.
We do, so get to it.
If you're
get
listening
to it,
here
listeners.
Right now on Spotify, just pop your phone open, chop a little, you know, five-star review on there, and then, you know, email us in. Give us the little ego stroke that you want. And this could be you. We could be reading out your email right now because Jacob here is an absolute legend, and he's surrounded by owls and isn't corrupted by the evil that must be. You know what I mean? Can you imagine the hellscape of being living in a place where owls are everywhere?
Them predators move in flocks. That is sadly all the time that we have for this week.
It is, unfortunately.
Join us next week where we are taking another dive into the beauty that is contemporary cinema.
What are we doing?
Joker.
Oh, we're doing Joker next week.
We're doing Joker with Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
Because somebody's got a sequel coming out.
Yes, they do. And I cannot wait for it. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing.
I've heard conflicting reviews.
I've heard nothing, so keep it to yourself. I'm going into this one blind. I made the mistake with Romulus. I'm going in this one blind.
Do it. Do it, do it, do it.
Guys, thank you so much for hanging out with us. We love each and every one of you so very much. No swearing.
We
see
really
that one?
Do. No swearing.
That was self-control.
Yeah. Well done. Oh, yeah. Well done.
Call me Michael Douglas, because I have just Nicholas the shit out of myself, mate.
Ah, six.
Mint. Mint. We love you so much. We really, really do. Thank you for hanging out with us. Next week, Rob just said it's going to be Joker. I didn't realize this, so I need to leave and watch Joker immediately.
In the meantime, just before Ben does, he is going to wrap up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of this week's film into a little Monday motivational pep talk to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of the week. It does mean the world. Yeah. And I'm just going to do what society and arguably this film tells you to do, which is... consume.
Do you ever feel a little bit sad about how much success you have just layered around your feet? You know, you're a little bit lonely, wandering your many hectare lands in downtown San Francisco, and you're thinking, but what really is the point of my life? Is this enough for me? Just bank on your little brother spending an absolute fortune to make the world stand still for your needs because you're so important. Oh, you're a little bit sad. I can't trust anyone. Boo fucking who? Yeah, seven in the swear jar. You know what? Make it eight. Fuck Michael Douglas in this film. Trust no one, but trust everyone, apparently. I don't know what this film is. It's a film.
Mate, I feel so much better after this.
Same. Also, fuck Fincher. Nine.
This is wrong. This is wrong. We're going to get so many owls, Ben. And crabs.
Crabs.
No, genuinely, man, I feel a lot better.
Same. Me too, man. Thank you for this.
I love this. I love you.
I love you too, man. I'll chat to you in a bit.
Gay.